So welcome to Ski Red Populum et Potentium, to know the people and power. I'm very happy to have Dr. Dean Baker, economist at the Economic Policy Institute and co-founder and economist at the Center for Economic Policy Research, where he serves as a senior economist. He's authored over 10 books on economics, one of which was my gateway drug into his works, The Conservative Nanny State. I wrote an extensive six-part review on this book as I found it in my own ignorance of economics, a revelation. This is among a very short list of books I would recommend to every American. Dean regularly contributes op-eds to news journals such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Truthout. He's an analyst that I believe should appear in every economic debate in the televised news media. And so therefore, he's not included in every economic debate. If I believe it should happen, it probably doesn't happen. But in any case, welcome, Dean, and I very much appreciate having you.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
So just to give a little bit of background, as I mentioned in the intro, your book, The Conservative Nanny State, was my introduction to your works. I heard Noam Chomsky mention the nanny state a few times in different talks, but it wasn't until he mentioned your name that it occurred to me that the term might be more than just something that he had created. So I looked it up and I found this book, and the simplicity of the book, so therefore the reachability, the accessibility of it, is incredible. And it certainly jived with my own sort of speculation about economics to begin with, but certainly makes it a lot clearer. And coming from an expert like you, it's pretty powerful stuff. So I guess I would want to ask, before we get into your origins, what do you think an economist is? So what is it that you do versus what is it do most economists do? And where are the conflicts? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think economics inevitably involves, you know, some fairly complex issues, studying data, knowing how to analyze data, knowing how to make sense of statistics. From my view, though, as an economist, and obviously there's divisions of labor here, but I see my responsibility as trying to, I do some primary analysis myself, but first and foremost, to make this information available and as understandable to people as possible. And it's common for economists to sort of throw up their hands and go, oh, this is complicated, people can't understand it. And I think of that as really being a cop-out. Our responsibility is to talk about this in terms people can understand. Because at the end of the day, I mean, I believe in democracy, people can't make intelligent choices unless they understand what's at stake. And their big economic issues have huge impact on people's lives. And if they don't understand how those choices are being determined, how those policies are being determined, you don't have a real democracy. So I think first and foremost, my job is about looking at important economic issues and trying to present them in ways that are understandable to people. I mean, I don't mind saying, I'm not going to deny, I have a progressive bent. I think we have too much equality. I think people should be able to count on the necessities of life, all that. But I think we will get there best by making the issues clear to people, because I think most people basically agree with those things. But
right.
In any case, the point is people have to understand first and foremost what's at issue. And it can be done. I just think a lot of economists, I sometimes joke about it, I think the economy is too simple for economists to understand.
Right. I like that.
Simple, not complicated.
Yeah, certainly the bridge education that I've had in economics has been built around laissez-faire market ideology, that the free market will be able to deliver the very best products and services for the best value, discounting considerable obstacles to that kind of optimization. And I think that what I've seen, at least in the limited social media that I look at on this topic, and this is looking at what fellow technologists are thinking about these things, they're pretty well hung up on this notion that profits proxy for everything that's good. To me, that seems more a dogma than something that's actually underwritten by the facts.
Yeah, well, it profits, I mean, what I always like to say, we should think of the market as a tool, and it could be a very, very powerful tool. But the point is, we structure, we decide how the tool will be used. So, do we want people to make profits selling heroin? We ban that now. So, obviously, you have a black market, but, you know, we do ban that. But we would be better off if people made profits on legally selling heroin. It's an arguable point. I mean, I think probably not, but, you know, that's a an arguable point. But in any case, for now, at least, we don't allow that. We don't allow it legally. And the whole point of, you know, certainly conservative nanny state and really much of my writings, we structure markets to decide how profits are made. And my most obvious example here, patent and copyright monopolies, the idea right. that somehow these are intrinsic, that Microsoft just has a copyright on Windows and they can make a huge amount of money on that. Well, that could, you could argue that's a good or bad thing, but that's not just the market. That was a government policy. We decided Microsoft can get a copyright and make a lot of money on it. We're going to arrest people if they start mass producing copies of computers that contain Windows and they're not paying Bill Gates' money. Again, we could argue whether it was a good or bad thing, but that was something we designed. That was how we structured the market. So what I do in Conservative Nanny State and other work is make a point. Here's how we're structuring the market. And again, you could argue, someone could defend the copyright system and say the current system's the best we could do. And that's an arguable proposition, but we have to understand that's not simply a market that was given to us. That was how we chose to structure it.
Exactly, that there's a legal framework underwriting all of that, and that it's not that somebody sat in a room and spent a long time working on some wonky optimization problem and said, I know what will work best. We'll just have a copyright system. I always thought it was kind of bananas that I would see, you know, popular songs that we might sing, like Christmas carols, and you find that they have copyrights from 120 years ago, you know, or at least whatever's listed in the fake book. The fake book's pretty old.
Yeah, it gets pretty crazy. I mean, both copyrights and patents have had bizarre applications, and some of the extreme ones, I remember hearing that I'm forgetting the name of them now, there's two main services that are involved in enforcing copyrights. So if a radio station plays copyright music, they have to pay a fee. And if, say, you have a restaurant or a bar and you're playing copyright music, you're supposed to pay. Now, I'm sure most of them don't, but in principle, you're supposed to pay. Well, anyhow, one of them was going after the Campfire Girls because they were singing copyrighted songs, you know, around their campfire. I mean, you get some pretty wacky things on this.
Right, and that you have to have a powerful nanny state to enforce those kinds of things.
Yeah. I mean, this is very far from a free market. I mean,
absolutely.
Girls sitting around a campfire and, you know, they're singing whatever songs, and now we're going to have the government come in there and say, oh, you have to pay whatever amount to, you know, so-and-so has the copyright on these.
Right. I doubt seriously that that my coworkers and bosses over at Microsoft would want me to say this, but I will say it anyway. I don't believe that the patenting and the copyright system has done justice to the software industry at all. I feel like Gates and Allen were able to exploit the open architecture, hardware architecture and so on, in order to be able to build an operating system on top of that they made proprietary. And because of the fact that it is proprietary and they've spent all of this time trying to ensure that those copyrights stay in place, we end up with products that, frankly, are subpar. I even told them that in my interview there. I told them that.
They hired you anyhow?
Yeah, and they called me back that
day. They really wanted you.
Yeah. Well, either it speaks to their desperation or their desperation, I guess. Either or.
Yeah. Or maybe they have an admirable respect for freedom of, you know, thought. Wow. You know, we could like to be optimistic about that. I don't know if that's the case, but we
right.
be optimistic that way. I'm not an expert on software. You clearly know much, much more about it, but I've heard that from many others, that much of what went the original, well, DOS, pre-runner of Windows, was taken from various forms of open software.
Unix, yeah.
On the government tab. And, right. And of course, it becomes proprietary. And I don't know anyone who's a regular user of Windows computers, which I am, that's very happy with, you know, if you gave me the option of the computer I had 20 years ago or the computer I had today, it, you know, some things clearly better, but a lot of things are not. So it's not as though we could look back over the last two decades and go, wow, there have been all these great innovations. The software I have today in my computer is so much better than what I had two decades ago. I, for one, wouldn't be able to say that.
And actually, internally at Microsoft, this is pretty well the opinion that we get every year when we do the internal surveys of the pillar issues that they ask opinions on. The most troublesome for the company are the tools that we have to use internally. And though they are slightly better than what you see on the outside, just because, you know, we're constantly being guinea pigged and they're constantly trying to make sure that our systems are reliable, it's not a good thing. The other tech companies I've worked at where they're basing their systems more on open source software, much more reliability. I mean, the difference is night and day. But it also raises another interesting point that I brought up with some of my coworkers when they ask questions about these kinds of things. It's one thing to patent, you know, or copyright a complex algorithm that you can use to achieve some particular goal. And let's say that an individual wants to benefit from that and see that his that others are not able to steal his work. That's different from a company doing it. And it's also different when we're talking about the scale and the scope of these algorithms. I like to ask them, how would you like to have to pay a fee every time you used the addition operator in your code? You know, I mean, it gets to a point where it's just obscene. That's like having a plumber install a toilet in your house and then you have to pay for every time you flush it.
It's, you know, again, we haven't, with our intellectual property system in general, I think there's been very little thought in the design as to, you know, is this really optimal? And you could argue for patents, you could argue for copyrights, but I think you'd be very hard pressed to look at the system we have today and say, this is the best we could do. And you have a lot of things that are almost like, you know, paying for every time you flush the toilet. I mean, particularly when you get to research tools, this comes up more with patents, I think, than copyrights. But, you know, a lot of times you have research tools that, because they're patented, they hugely raise the cost of research.
Right, right. Absolutely. And to say nothing of medical equipment and then the pharmaceutical industry. So my father-in-law worked for Dial and for Pfizer, and he let me in on a lot of the tricks that they use for evergreening that I wrote about actually in the book review that I did for your book, because I wanted to augment it with some of the information that he was giving me about how they are able to, by virtue of the way that they do the research, you end up with a mirror copy of drug molecules, and usually there's some utility to those. And it's not necessarily the utility you'd planned, but you get to double dip and get two patents for the price of one. But I think the number that bothers me the most is the copycat drug share of the market. To me, it's obscene. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, again, we get into sort of a strange debate, at least I find it often gets very strange when we talk about patents and prescription drugs, because, of course, it costs a lot of money to do research and developing new drugs, and someone has to pay for that. But the question, what is the best way to do that? And, again, we've settled on the patent system where basically what we're doing is we're telling companies, go ahead, do research, and then we'll give you a patent, and then you basically get monopoly on it for 20 years.
Right.
And we were saying with evergreening, they often find ways to extend that for a number of years. Another way, it's not quite evergreening, it's kind of a variation on it, is that oftentimes companies will have several patents on a drug, and the main one may expire, and then what they do is they have a very dubious patent that they claim to prevent competitors from marketing their drug, marketing as a generic. And even though it may not stand up in court, you have an incredible asymmetry. You're looking to come in there as a generic entry. Well, you're looking to be able to sell it at the competitive market price. That might be a 10th, even a 20th, maybe even less of what the price Pfizer could charge is. So there's an incredible asymmetry. If you envision a lawsuit, Pfizer stands much more to lose than the generic does to gain, which means that they're prepared to spend a lot of money on the lawsuit. It doesn't make sense for the generic to spend anything remotely comparable because they don't stand to gain that much. So often, Pfizer could have a patent, but they know it's very weak, but they'll just tell a generic that's trying to enter, well, we're going to contest this, and if we lose, we're going to appeal it. We'll appeal it to the Supreme Court. You're going to be buried in legal fees. It's just not worth your while. And that's often a way to keep generics out of the market because for them, it just doesn't make sense. Getting back to the basic picture, you know, this is one of the things I often say to people when I'm giving a talk. I often begin, drugs are cheap, and they immediately think I'm nuts. And the point that I make with that is that almost invariably they're cheap to produce. So if you just talk about manufacturing a drug profitably, in most cases, that would be $10, $15, maybe $30 at the outside per prescription. And we know this because there are generic drugs here and in other countries. India has a world-class generic industry. They produce very high-quality drugs, and in almost all cases, they're very, very cheap. Whereas if they're patent-protected, they could sell for thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars. And again, it's because they have a monopoly on the drug people need for their health, they need for their life. It's this absurd situation where people are struggling in trying to get their insurer to pay. Hepatitis C, there have been several drugs recently, but originally Sovaldi was the first breakthrough drug that could cure hepatitis C, which is a debilitating and sometimes deadly disease.
Sure.
$80,000 per 3-month course of treatment. Incredibly expensive. So insurers didn't want to pay. People who were on Medicaid, other government programs, the government didn't want to pay. And you had articles about this as a big moral dilemma. Should they pay for everyone? A lot of people have hepatitis C. They've lived, you know, they're drug addicts. You know, they've done things in their life that you might say weren't very good. Should we pay $84,000 for them to be treated? And I'll just say, okay, that's a good question. You know, I mean, I'd probably be inclined to pay it, but whatever. You understand people saying no. We go, well, actually, it doesn't cost $84,000 to manufacture this drug. It costs $200 or $300. And again, we know this because that's what they, the generics in India could sell it for. And again, they make money. They're not charities.
Right.
At $200 or $300, that's really kind of a no-brainer. I mean, you aren't going to spend $300 to save someone's life, to cure them of a debilitating disease. I mean, even if they got it because they were a drug addict or whatever, I mean, that'd be nuts. So we create this huge problem for ourselves with how are we going to pay for these expensive drugs when they wouldn't be expensive if we didn't have the patent monopolies. So it's, as I say, it's a very, very perverse way of financing drug research. And again, we have to pay for it. So I don't argue that. I talk about other ways to pay for it, mostly through direct pay for the funding research up front, pay for it up front and have it be in the public domain. But the current system, I just think, is incredibly backward. And, you know, it's a big deal economically, but even more so, this is people's health, people's lives.
Right. Yeah. Chomsky's read on the history of technology has been something that's similar, that in essence, the computers that we're using right now to talk and the vast international and actually transnational communications network, originally it was just going to be a, you know, coast-to-coast network for communication. All of it was developed in the public sector. And the public sector bore the risk. And lots of things didn't pan out that we don't hear about. But nonetheless, it was not a free market that delivered computers to us or the internet or, you know, a lot of the R&D, as you point out in your books, a lot of the R&D that goes into the development of these drugs.
Yeah, and even as it stands, you know, with the National Institutes of Health, they get $40 billion a year or so from the federal government. Again, most of that is more basic research, so it's not common that they're actually developing drugs. But there are cases, important cases, AZT, the first major AIDS drugs, that was actually developed by NIH money. As it was developed as a cancer drug. It turned out not to be an effective cancer drug. And then in the 80s, several private boroughs, Wellcome was the big one. They then tested as an AIDS drug where it turned out to be an effective treatment. But a very large chunk of the expense, you know, certainly developing the drug originally, and as I understand, even some of the research done by Burroughs Wellcome was financed by the federal government. So again, you look at drug after drug. Someone did an analysis recently looking at drugs that were in the last, I forget how far back they went, like last decade. Every single one of them had a major role for federal. So that's not to say the industry didn't do something. In most cases, they made substantial contributions. But the point was they were building on work done by the federal, or I should say paid for by the federal government.
Right. And probably like the big banks, underwritten by the federal government at the same time. So you have this extremely skewed loss function of no way to lose and every way to gain.
Yeah, it often looks that way.
Yeah, yeah. So somebody that I had discussed this with had made the comment that copycat drugs were good because therefore there was market competition.
As though prescription drugs are developed in a free market or laissez-faire framework, there seems to be this pervasive belief amongst intelligentsia that not only is that usually the system that's operating, but that that's the system that should operate universally. We know that's not true based on just some of the few things that we've already discussed. How do we dispel that?
In terms of how you you know, get people to think more clearly on it. I mean, you know, I kind of like patents and copyrights just because they are such blatant interferences in the market. And we'll find ways, you know, I love to point out, well, we can get a drug in India for, in some cases, less than 1% of what it costs here. And, you know, if people want to be strict libertarians, go, fine, let me go to India. Let me import the drug from India. And let's say Pfizer would go nuts if we just said, oh, we could just import all these generics from India. They would, you know, they'd put them out of business in no time. So, you know, that's a very clear mechanism. But there are so many other ways. I mean, one of the things that was striking to me when we had the bailout of the banks in 2008, well, the market outcome, of course, is Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and Bank of America. They're all out of business. They, you know, they got themselves in trouble because they made a lot of bad loans and they couldn't cover their debts. And, well, in a market economy, they're all out of business. Well, people couldn't raise fast enough to engineer the bailout to keep them going. And somehow that
was basically market. And in both parties.
And in both parties. It was totally bipartisan. I was on the Hill talking to skeptics. They were Democrats. I mean, they're also skeptics who are Republicans, but I was meeting skeptics on the Democratic side. And there were a lot of people, of course, who did have questions, many who did vote against it. More Republicans voted against it than Democrats. But in any case, there were those who voted against it. But basically, they scared all these people saying, oh, the economy's going to disappear. And I go, what are you talking about? But they just were saying this. And just to be clear, I don't mean to say there wouldn't have been greater disruption had you not had the bailouts. There would have been. But the economy would just disappear. I mean, you go, what do you mean? You know, where the physical banks aren't going anywhere. So all the banks that, you know, we have our deposits, they're still going to be there the next day. Their records aren't going to go anywhere. And we actually do have a mechanism, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, to keep operating, keep normal bank services going through a crisis, which isn't to say everything would have been perfect. But there was just this idea, we have to rescue them. And of course, here we are now, 10 years, a little more than 10 years later. And those banks, Citigroup, Bank of America, they're bigger than ever.
Yeah.
But you can't call that a free market.
No, not at all. And I think you write in Rigged that the IMF, actually it may not have been that the IMF stated this, but that these big banks are able to borrow at a much better rate than they would be under normal circumstances because of the government insurance policy.
Yeah, so there was research that the IMF had done. This is a few years ago now, and it may not still hold up because risks have fallen. That was still kind of in the wake of the crisis. But what their research had found, I've done some too, showing this, that their borrowing costs were less than smaller banks because the presumption was if Citigroup got itself in trouble, the government would come to its rescue, just as, it, of course, it did do in 2008 and 2009. So obviously, if you think from the standpoint of someone, you're looking to lend Citigroup $20 million or another bank $20 million, well, you're going to be thinking, I really don't have much risk with Citigroup. It's obviously a big bank and not likely to go under simply because big banks don't typically go under. But even if it were to go under, I could still count on the government bailing it out and making me whole. So that means you'd be willing to lend at a lower rate of interest. And that's certainly what the IMF found. You know, again, this was a few years ago, but you know, that was, you know, it was a careful research. I don't think people disputed that at the time.
And you were credited as being one of the few economists that actually was able to predict the housing bubble.
Yeah, I mean, for this is a source of incredible frustration because it's sort of like you see a disaster coming and you're trying to warn about it and no one's really listening. And, you know, to my view, it was not hard to see for anyone looking at the data because it was just very, very clear. We had this unprecedented run up in house prices. And I had data going back to the early 50s. The government, Robert Shiller, was an economist at Yale. He subsequently won a Nobel Prize. He constructed a data using public data sets, but he had to construct himself going back to the 1890s. And we had never seen a run up in house prices, anything like this. House prices generally nationwide, at least, pretty much track the overall rate of inflation. So suddenly in the late 90s, they began to diverge from the overall rate of inflation. And in the next decade, quite sharply, so 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, they're rising at double digit levels. There's no corresponding increase in rents. Rents are pretty much tracking the rate of inflation. Vacancy rates are actually high and rising. That doesn't make sense. It's not consistent with the tight labor market. So I'm looking at this and go, how could that not be a bubble? And the reason bubbles were on my mind, and not someone goes bubble, 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 but we just stock market bubble, which collapsed in 2001, the recession that year. And that was a big deal. So the idea that we might get bubbles in asset markets shouldn't have been crazy to people in 2002, 3, 4. We had just seen a really big one collapse and gave us a recession. So I saw this in the housing market, and the reason why I thought the impact was likely to be really big was housing had grown to be a very large share of the economy. Housing ordinarily is around 4% GDP. It hit a peak of, I think it was 6.8% GDP in 2005. So it was way above its historic average. And on top of that, people were consuming based on their housing wealth. So if people bought a home for $200,000, suddenly worth $400,000. A lot of people were borrowing against their homes. None of this was secret, by the way. I mean, I talk about this like, you know, I had to have some special insider debt. Alan Greenspan actually wrote papers on this.
Really?
He actually went back and he had equity. I'm forgetting the term he used, something like equity withdrawal. Spending from equity withdrawal. He had some term for it. I mean, I don't know if he invented it, but in any case, he had used this in several papers. So it wasn't any sort of secret that A, you know, housing construction was soaring to record levels, and B, that people were spending based on their housing wealth. It was widely reported, and you know, the whole point being that when the wealth disappeared, so would the spending. So that's exactly what happened. Of course, the bubble peaks in 06, begins to drop at the fall of 06, drops more rapidly in 07, because basically the story you had in the housing market was people were buying homes where they look at the house and go, is this worth 400,000? They might have said no, but because the price is rising 10 or 15 or 20% every year, it doesn't matter. So, you know, you might say to yourself, well, I wouldn't pay 400,000 for this house, but on the other hand, since it's going to be worth 500,000 in 2 years, yeah, why not? But suddenly when that reverses, when the price is falling rather than rising, well, then you look at it and go, oh, yeah, it's probably not worth $400,000. Maybe I shouldn't pay $400,000 for it. And, of course, the banks wouldn't make the loans anymore. So you got house prices falling in 07 and then very rapidly later by the latter part of the year because it feeds on itself. And that was, you know, that was the story of the crash. House prices plummeted. And then, of course, residential construction plummeted. So as I said, it ordinarily had been around 4% GDP. It fell back to less than 2% GDP. So we went from being close to 6.8% to less than 2%, that's 4.5 percentage points of GDP. That'd be $900 billion a year in today's economy. So how are you going to replace that? And then that you had the big fall in consumption because, again, you had all these people, their house went from 200,000 to 400,000. They take out a home equity loan. They use to buy a car, take a vacation. Maybe they're sending their kids to school. So it's not that it was a stupid, frivolous thing to do. They thought the house was going to still be worth 400,000, but then ends up being worth 200. Well, suddenly they can't do that anymore.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I saw, so in my husband's family's neighborhood in Scottsdale, we saw housing prices rise to just astronomical numbers. It was remarkable. Houses that were previously like $400,000 up to $1.2 million. And then all of that just completely vanished. And we used to live in the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex, and I can remember construction happening out the wazoo all over the place in the areas around the metropolitan area where there were, you know, basically just open fields and some farmland. And I couldn't believe that that many people would be moving into those houses, especially with so many houses on the market. But we ended up buying high and selling low. So
yeah. I wish. Sorry to hear that.
Fortunately, we didn't lose a lot of money, but, and it was nothing to complain about compared to what other people had to endure through all of that, the humiliation and, you know, the bankruptcies, foreclosures, just dreadful stuff. And the fact that this is done and it's understood, it has to be understood at top levels of power. Would you say that that's the case, or do they genuinely not understand how this stuff works?
I think they genuinely did not understand. I mean, I knew people know some of these people. I really think that they what happens is you get this groupthink story that people talk to each other. They only take the opinions into account of other people that they think are really important honchos. So, you know, if you're, I mean, obviously it helps I'm an economist as opposed to someone just off the street, but still, you know, I don't have a Nobel Prize. They don't have to listen to me. So they don't have to count what I'm saying. And I remember being on a panel once and I was talking about the risk of a house price decline. And it was a fairly prominent economist. He's just totally dismissive. He just said, well, we've never seen anything like what you're describing. And my whole point was, no, we've never seen a nationwide fall in house prices like this because we've never seen a nation run up in house prices like this. Now, that seemed fairly straightforward to me. Right. He was just totally dismissive. Like, I'm talking about something that's just, you know, otherworldly.
Right.
To me, that was very concrete.
I like the way that you described it earlier, that economics is much simpler than people think, because I was going to say something similar at the beginning of this discussion about how, on the one hand, it seems like economics is much simpler than what people think, but on the other hand, you know, theoretical economists start, you know, delving into MP hard optimization problems and Nash equilibria and, you know, all of these interesting things that don't pay that much attention to the pragmatic. And I guess that sort of brings me to Piketty. I know that you've written about him and talked about his works quite a bit, particularly Capital in the 21st Century, which I've started, but I can't say that I've finished yet. There's a lot in there. But I guess what is your take on this? That it appears as though there's a schism in the field of economics.
Yeah, well, I think that a lot of economics, you know, I was joking about this, but this is actually very serious. I think it's about making simple things complicated.
Yeah.
I'll give you, I mean, of course, my analysis of the housing bubble was pretty simple. And, you know, people asked me if I, you know, as this was going on, did I getting it published anywhere, and kind of shrugged because I go, you know, it's too simple. I don't know where I can get published. I mean, it was basically a very simple story. And I actually had that, you know, exactly that, because there was a similar issue with back in 05, President Bush wanted to privatize Social Security.
Oh, yeah.
His big argument was that, oh, we're going to give people individual accounts and they'll make way more money. They'll all accounts.
Yeah.
And that was based on their assumption on stock returns. And what I was arguing was that you can't have the high stock returns that they're talking about, given that they're projecting slow economic growth and that price earnings ratios in the stock market were already quite high. If you had low price earnings ratios, you could do it, but we didn't have low, we had high. So I was saying you cannot get the returns that they're predicting. So a friend of mine, Brad DeLong, called me up and said, do you want to do this as a Brookings paper? And he goes, I can drag it to Paul Krugman, which he did. And I said, well, is this really a Brookings paper? I mean, because it's simple. It's, you know, it's basically algebra. There's, you know, what are dividends? What are capital gains? You know, it's adding two numbers. And he said, oh, yeah, no, it could be a Brookings paper. So I wanted to do my work on this. So I wrote it up, gave the basic algebra. So Brad goes, oh, thank you very much. The bulk of the work, Krugman did some too. I don't mean to downgrade his role, but Brad was the main actor here. But anyhow, he totally rewrites it. And he basically has two pieces. So one was an intertemporal consumption optimization model. And then the other was the point I was making, which was, again, basically simple algebra. Brad rewrote it, but basically took the, you know, presented the argument.
Mm-hmm.
What made it the Brookings paper, of course, was the optimization model, which was complex, but it was certainly more complex than simple algebra.
Right.
When we actually presented the paper, no one said a word about the optimization model. No one could care less. Yeah. All they cared about was the simple algebra. But, you know, without having something, you know, with some calculus in there and, you know, that you could kind of wave your hand and go, oh, yeah, this is complicated. We wouldn't have got there as a Brookings paper. So it was just a clear as day that, you know, okay, you have to make this complicated to get through the door, even though that has nothing to do with the issue at hand.
I wish I could say I was surprised by that. that. But I've spent enough time, been in and out of academia enough times that, yes, that's definitely true, that oftentimes you can present something that is even novel and advances the science. I had a classmate at Georgia Tech who submitted a paper to one of the theoretical computer science symposia, and they thought the result was momentous, but the proof was too simple, so therefore they didn't want to accept it.
Oh God!
And they actually outright said that they weren't hiding it. They weren't saying, this really wasn't good work. They were just saying, we like the result, but the proof is elementary. So, so therefore we can't publish it.
It's amazing. They wouldn't be embarrassed that, you know, are we trying to advance the science, or are we just trying to spin our wheels and,
or make ourselves look so complicated that we can, you know, I don't know, to achieve some kind of dominance in the field, maybe. The more David Attenborough programs that I see, the more I realize that we're just animals. that's a little bit cynical. So one thing that is in the news right now, I noticed that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez mentioned the 70% tax on $10 million and above, and that Paul Krugman, actually I learned about her quote by reading one of Paul Krugman's columns on this, and it looks like Piketty, and I'll never be able to say these names, Stancheva and Saez, I believe is the
name. Yeah, Saez, yeah.
Okay, that they say that it's 83%. But through the last 20 years, since the Bush W tax cuts were pushed through, I have told people repeatedly about the top marginal tax rates that we had at the end of World War II, when we had some of the greatest growth, if not the greatest amount of growth that we ever saw in American history, economic history. And so I wanted you to weigh in on that also. So how this 70% versus 83%, the numbers are sort of, they're not immaterial, but the concept is important. How do we tax the wealthy in an optimal way?
Yeah, well, there are two issues. The more important one is this idea that if they face a high tax rate that, we lose out, you know, all these, you know, very highly talented people.
Which is bullshit. They don't contribute that kind of work to the economy.
Yeah, and you know, and you know, I guess I would divide those into two groups. So when you get the people defending it, they always, you know, like Greg Mankiw was Bush's, the head of his Council of Economic Advisors, always will say, oh, well, Taylor Swift, you know, don't you like Taylor Swift's music or whatever? And she wouldn't perform if, you know, she's going to be taxed at some really high rate. And you know, A, that's not true. I mean, the vast majority of people are not Taylor Swift. I mean, whether you like it or not, I am not particularly a Taylor Swift fan, but whatever. You know, it's the vast majority of people who are in those income brackets are people on Wall Street who are shuffling money. They're corporate CEOs. The people get a lot because they have, you know, they inherited their wealth.
The rentier culture, yeah.
Yeah, so that's who we're generally talking about. But even the Taylor Swifts, I mean, the example I like to use there is Michael Jordan, who maybe was the best basketball player ever. During the prime of his playing years, he took 2 years off to play baseball. Now, suppose he had faced the 90% marginal tax rate. Would he have decided that he had so much money that he could spend 2 years playing baseball? Maybe would have, I don't know, but he may well not have. And, you know, certainly Jordan was a fantastic player. And if you enjoy seeing Michael Jordan play, we actually might have gotten more Michael Jordan with a higher tax rate than a lower tax rate. Wow. But again, that's not who we're talking about for the most part. We're talking about, you know, the corporate CEOs, the people shuffling paper. So I'm not worried about not giving them enough incentive to do what they do for the economy. In most cases, they would probably do the same. And in the cases where you had a CEO said, well, you know, if I have to pay a 70% or 80% tax rate, not worth it to me, you know, my view would be, well, fine, we'll take the next person in line. It's not as though, I mean, some CEOs who were extraordinary, Steve Jobs, you know, kept making complaints about what Apple's done and everything, but he was a visionary, you know, so yeah. If Jobs had said that, okay, we would have lost something, but the vast, vast majority of CEOs are not Steve Jobs. So if they said, hey, it's not worth it for me, it would not be a big loss to the economy. The part I do worry about, and you have to decide where this kicks in, is what they will do by way of evasion avoidance, because that is a loss to the economy. That it's, it both don't get the revenue, but it also means it creates a tax shelter industry. And that's what I worry about. So I would probably put a number certainly below the 83%, probably some below the 70. Important point to remember here, we also have state and local taxes. And in the case of, say, California, someone who's earning $10 million a year is facing a 13% state income tax. So I'd probably be more comfortable with something closer to 50%, because I don't want to, as you get to high tax rates, you're giving people a lot of incentive to evade your tax, to avoid your tax. And that's just a loss to the economy. Not, you know, again, I'm not worried that they're going to say, oh, I don't feel like working for that. But it's a loss to the economy that they're paying people to come up with various gimmicks so that, you know, they don't have to pay their taxes, because that itself is a drain on the economy. I mean, if we have a tax shelter industry where all these people are making their living by thinking up ways to game the tax code, well, those people aren't doing anything productive. So that's what I worry about.
And it would certainly be valuable to the economy to get rid of the tax lawyers.
Exactly.
most of them anyway.
You know, well, no, I mean, seriously, we want a system that involves as little as possible in terms of compliance and enforcement cost. So Right. We have to ask not just about, oh, is it going to mean that, you know, this CEO or this Wall Street guy is going to work a little less if we have a 70% tax rate? That doesn't concern me. It's more, you know, how many additional tax lawyers and accountants are we going to have who, instead of doing something productive in the world, they're going to be coming up with games. That's what I worry about.
Right, right. I guess that I would be somewhat optimistic and hope that at least the good guy CEOs would be willing to reroute the money that they would be getting in salary back into the company for the profitability of the company. Good Lord, that's something we haven't even touched on, is simply the history of corporations and indefinite charters and all that. But I want to rewind a little bit before we get onto that. Well, so I want to go back to the beginning for you, where you are from and what is it that interested you in economics and what is it that interested you in progressivism, activism? I know that you did, you participated in sit-in protests against the Contras in Nicaragua. And you had a very interesting advisor who was, I guess, by all accounts, a Marxist economist.
Yeah, Locke Anderson.
Yeah, Locke Anderson.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Chicago under the Daley machine, so I always had a sense politics was kind of corrupt and really needed to be cleaned up. And this was back in the days of the Vietnam War, and I had the sense the Vietnam War was at least a very serious mistake. You know, it's easy to see that a lot of things that our government was saying weren't true. I remember I read a book by Fulbright, who's the head of the Foreign Service Committee and a big critic of the Vietnam War. And it you know, gave an account of the history, which I'd not heard. You know, I was a casual reader. You know, at this point, I'm like 11, 12 reader of the newspaper, but it was certainly an account I hadn't heard, and I realized, you know, oh my God, we're, you know, this makes no sense, our involvement in the war. And anyhow, so I had a sense things were really not going as they should. And I actually came into economics just my last year in college because I felt economics was important, but I didn't like the mainstream of the field. And I had a professor my last year there, David Wyman. And I got to talking with him. I was very interested in the economics he was doing, and decided my senior year that I took economics with him, I decided I'd go to grad school in econ. You probably couldn't do that today because I didn't have, you know, big background, but I was lucky I did well on tests. So I was able to do well on my GREs and everything. Always been good at math. So I was able to get in. And, you know, in economics, it was, I was always interested in, like, okay, how could I learn this stuff to be a voice to criticize the mainstream of the profession? And, you know, that was what I was thinking about in grad school. You mentioned the sit-ins at our congressman's office. This was the 80s. The U.S. was actively involved as Reagan years trying to undermine the revolution.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I just thought was you know, just incredibly pernicious. I mean, for people who don't know the background, I realize it's ancient history now, that was 40 years ago. There was a very corrupt dictatorship that had been installed by the United States. That's not a euphemism. It had literally been installed by the United States back in the 30s. We put in Anastasio Somoza's father, who passed it on to his kid. And anyhow, it was very corrupt, and needless to say, they didn't care at all about the needs of the people. There was no money going for healthcare and education. You know, they were pocketing money left and right. It would have been a poor country in any case, but you know, they weren't sharing what they did have. And they were overthrown in a revolution, 79, the Sandinistas' armed revolution. They managed to overthrow them. And Carter was still president at that time. He didn't want the Sandinistas to come to power. He was trying to keep them from coming to power. He wasn't able to work out a deal. He was doing his best to try to work out something and basically kept them out of power while getting rid of Somoza. He wasn't able to do that. They came to power, and they were very much committed towards providing health care, education, meeting the basic needs of the people. Under Reagan, he very quickly got remnants of the National Guard, which is the army that supports Somoza, and he began arming them, and they basically did a terror war, where they would, you know, do attacks on villages. They'd come over the border from Honduras. There was also a group in Costa Rica. They'd come over the border, and they'd attack whatever they could, which often was, you know, hospitals or schools. As I said, terrorism is the right word. And that continued through the 80s. And our congressperson, who had been a moderate Republican, they redistricted in 1980 for the 82 election and made a much more conservative district. He suddenly became a very conservative Republican following the district, and he supported Reagan on that. So that was the basis. I was in any number of protests. Actually challenged him for the seat in 86. Wasn't my intention, but we couldn't get anyone else to do it. We got the Democratic nomination and got 41%. It was not close, but it was way more than anyone expected. But anyhow, I felt that was an important thing to do. I mean, I don't regret at all, you know, having tried to oppose the U.S. actions there. And, you know, I think we see it again today. The U.S., you know, it's embalming Venezuela again.
Yes.
And the Maduro government, they're corrupt. They've done, you know, really horrible things in terms of, you know, what's happened with their economy and its impact on the people. I mean, it's not just numbers. People aren't getting food. They aren't getting medicine. So it's a really bad story. But our concern there, the concern of the U.S. government, is not that Venezuelan people are suffering, because that's never been a concern of our government.
Right.
It's an anti-U.S. government, and they want to see it overthrown.
Our presence in Latin America has been brutal and horrendous since the founding of the colonies.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it doesn't seem to change. I mean, you keep hoping, you know.
Every single president promises not to be an interventionist like the previous one.
Yeah.
And then they say, we must look forward and not backward, which I think was one of the most disillusioning things I heard Obama say. Oh, goodness. Not that I want to talk about Trump necessarily, because we hear enough about him. But we've been controlling their economies using trade agreements, which are anti-market forces. And I can't believe that the self-described free marketeers in the Republican Party believe that they're promoting democracy or free market ideology.
My guess, you know, that's ascribing a level of, you know, thought of, you know, planning that I think really is not true.
Institutional independence or free-mindedness. Yeah, I agree with you.
So I think they're going, okay, you know, NAFTA or the Trans-Pacific Partnership's coming up. How do I vote? And, you know, they're getting the lobbyists calling them. They're hearing, you know, the party leadership saying. And I think that's, you know, 99% of the time what determines how they vote. Well, what does this actually do? I think, you know, most of them have very little idea what it actually does.
I don't know if you're familiar with the works of George Monbiot. He's a naturalist journalist over in Britain, and he has some interesting things to say about the narrative that people have been fed, that it is this neoliberal narrative, even though you would ask any American on the street what neoliberal means, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. But that he thinks that we need some kind of cohesive narrative to be able to explain to people how our economy actually works, how we're told it works, and what the differences are. But I think people are pretty smart when it comes to these things. They may be ignorant of the facts, but it's not as though they don't understand them when the facts are expressed.
Yeah, and I think of my job as an economist about making these things clear to people. And my blog Beat the Press, and what that's about is criticizing reporting, because I think the biggest problem, of course, most people aren't going to be reading government documents that a more informed person reads through the Washington Post or New York Times, major papers. Most people don't, but that I'm saying a more informed person. And when I focus on those papers and they're not giving people information in a way that's understandable, that's a real big problem. I'll just give you my pet one, which it just kind of drives me nuts, because there literally is no other side to it. When you see a budget number that's expressed in millions or billions or tens of billions, it's giving no information.
Yes, I read that on one of your blog posts about the lack of context.
Yeah, and no one disagrees on that. I mean, I've never found a reporter who tries to tell me that when they write down the transportation budget is $180 billion over the next 6 years, that any substantial segment of their readers, and I'm talking about New York Times readers. I don't mean, if this were in the New York Post, and most of the people aren't that educated. I mean, New York Times readers, all of whom have college degrees, many have advanced degrees, law degrees, whatever. They don't know what the budget is. So if you told them $180 billion for 6 years, you could have added a zero, taken away a zero. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that's all they know. And, of course, what's relevant is how large is that relative to the total budget? Is this a big thing in terms of the total budget? Is it a small thing? And most people have no idea. So I've been haranguing them. It's really not that hard to just put it in some context. The most obvious one to me is put it in percentage terms, but, there are different ways you could do it. So, if you said $180 billion over 6 years, that's $30 billion a year. It's about 0.7% of the budget. So if you told people 0.7%, most people, that gives them a reasonably good idea. It's not a huge share of the budget. It's not altogether trivial. But, if you cut it by 20%, it's not like you have a lot of money in your pocket. If you raised it by 20%, not as though that's going to be a huge increase in the deficit or, a big tax increase. Anyhow, if you put it as a percentage of the budget, it would hugely help in terms of informing people. Where I think this issue comes up most clearly is when you talk about a lot of social spending spending on the poor that is almost very, very, very small in terms of the whole budget.
It's dirty pennies in the couch cushions. I mean, it's nothing compared to the overall budget.
And so if you take TANF, the temporary assistance for needed families, the main welfare program,
the food stamps,
a year. So that translates, it's less than 0.5% of the budget.
Yeah.
So a big argument, is this money well spent? Is it poorly spent? But it's important, you go, okay, it's a horrible program. I want to zero it out. You go, okay, we got your wish. You're not going to have much more money in your pocket because we lowered your taxes. It's 0.5%, less than 0.5% of the federal budget. So it's not all your money is going to these people you don't like. You might not like the people. Maybe you don't think they should get the money, but it's really not going to affect your tax burden in any big way. And people don't understand that.
I feel like institutionally, not just the government, the various agencies and branches of the government, but also the media don't have much of an incentive to make things clear. An example is I've been staying down here in Tucson the last couple months because of the short term that I'm on. I've been staying with my aunt and uncle, and my uncle watches CNN almost incessantly, which means that all I ever hear about is Trump and screaming. And that literally is about it. There's almost no content that is provided. I'll switch on Democracy Now, and my aunt and uncle are amazed at how much stuff is out there that people aren't hearing about. And, having experts on that can spend 15 minutes explaining something to you instead of 30 seconds screaming at other painted up people.
It's one of the things I will say I really don't understand, because I think of New York Times, which is clearly the country's preeminent newspaper. Mm-hmm. I've had this argument with reporters there, editors there for decades now. And I remember about 5 years ago, maybe even a little longer, Margaret Sullivan, who at that time was the public editor, she wrote a piece on this, you know, at my haranguing, you know, I and others had, you know, really pushed on this, you know, the issue about putting budget numbers in context. She agreed completely. She said, yes, no one knows. And she brought in David Leonhard, who at that time was their Washington editor. So, you know, important person there, controlled, or had a lot of say, I should say. I don't know exactly who controls, but he has a lot of say about how things appear in print. And he goes, yeah, we might just write really big number. That was exactly the line I said. He's welcome to take it, but whatever. You know, we might as well just write really big number because no one knows what these are. So here you have the public editor, the Washington editor, both agreeing with me completely, saying, you know, look, it's irresponsible to put these big numbers in there with no content because no one has any idea what they mean. So I actually went out. I remember I celebrated, you know, I go, holy shit, you know, this is a big, you know, if the New York Times does this, well, then probably a Washington Post will follow, National Public Radio will follow. And, you know, we picked up this will be standard. I was going, this is fantastic. Nothing changed.
Yeah.
You just go, what is this? I mean, I'm not asking them to do any big thing. It's not like I'm asking them to go research some boring topic that they have no. The numbers are right there. I don't believe their reporters are stupid. If you wrote down $20 billion, come on, you could put it on an Excel spreadsheet, a hand calculator. Probably most of them could do it in their head. You know,
right.
This is really simple stuff.
Yeah, apparently the Brookings did a survey a few years ago. They've probably done more surveys along this type since of the Tea Partiers. The surveys demonstrated a thorough ignorance on how much spending goes towards TANF and foreign aid. And it's interesting that they believe that more money should go to it than actually is going to it. And they also believe that more money is going to it than they think the number should be.
Yeah, no, I've seen those things. Yeah. I don't know if I saw that specific Brookings one. But, you know, I often say if I thought as much money was going to these programs as those people thought, I'd be opposed to them too. I mean, if I thought 30% of the budget, and a lot of these people think that TANF is getting 30% of the budget, I mean, I would be looking and going, we're spending 30% of the budget, you know, $1.5 trillion a year, and we still have all these poor people?
Yeah.
That doesn't look like a really good program. You know, so, you know, again, and I understand some of it goes the other way. Some of them are racist and they want to believe really bad things about these people. But you have people that aren't racist. They actually think we want to help poor people. They just say, oh, we're spending too much because they think we're spending, you know, 10 or 20 times as much as we're actually spending.
Right, right. And that was the case with a lot of them. They wanted there to be aid for single mothers with children, with, you know, minor children.
Yeah.
And but they were opposed to welfare or food stamps. When they heard the terms that have been racially charged, then suddenly they're opposed to it. So yeah, it makes for a very interesting lot of people in the United States. I guess there were a couple more questions I wanted to ask you.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much. This is awesome. I mean, to actually be able to ask you questions is fantastic. So limited liability. I recently had a back and forth with somebody on LinkedIn, and much to my surprise, what I said actually won him over. I wasn't expecting that to be the case, but he was piling on to this notion that corporations are these magical unicorns that have been given from on high that are able to come to these optimal strategies, which of course, if you know anything about high dimensional, even convex optimization, but non-convex optimization is ridiculously hard. But they somehow get in their mind that these corporations are given from on high and are able to do this all on their own, and that it's just government regulation that's impeding them. So I raised the concept of limited liability and how that's actually an anti-market, which I got, I mean, I pulled this straight from your book. So this information came from you. So I'd like for you to discuss limited liability a little bit and how it does not follow any kind of free market ideology.
Yeah. So, no. Yeah, I've often had fun with libertarians, you know, who want to say they want to get the government out of the economy. So I go, you want to get rid of corporations? And they look at me like, what are you talking about?
Exactly.
Well, you know, you I could form a, but a corporation has legal status because of the government, and specifically legal liability, limited liability. I mean, there's other benefits as well, but first and foremost. And what that means, of course, is, you know, you could have a corporation that they do bad to people and, you know, we sue them. And guess what? They don't have enough money and we're out of luck. And, you know, if you and I had a partnership and we did that, well, we'd lose everything we had. Right. But in the case of a corporation, you know, I had, you know, 50,000 stock or whatever, or I could lose that. But, you know, I could still have millions of dollars. They can't touch that. And, you know, okay, that's arguably, you know, that was a good thing for us to create corporations, grant them limited liability. I shouldn't say arguably. I mean, I think it was. But we have to understand that is a government action. That was a policy. We're not free marketeers if we believe that the government should be able to grant corporations limited liability. Point I make on this, and I think this is, you know, tremendously underappreciated. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that in reading your book and then reading some on the history of the corporation, I can't think of the author's name. It'll come back to me. But I think you cite in your book. But the corporate charters that were issued were often predicated on some temporary service. So they needed to raise capital to build a bridge or pave a road, with the exception of shipping and railroads and interstate commerce kinds of things, because that made sense to have more of a lasting requirement for raising capital. So how is it that we have these charters issued that last indefinitely now? And what was the justification for it?
Yeah, so if you go back to English common law, the corporation, as you said, it was designed for specific public service, building a canal, you know, South China, South Sea Trading Company, the East India Trading Company. So there are very specific purposes that it was thought to serve a public purpose to allow, you know, this special status of limited liability. And, you know, in England, that continued to be the case well into the 19th century. They didn't have a general incorporation law until, I think it was 1867, if I remember correctly. In the U.S., we had it earlier. It was actually in, I think it was 1817, that we adopted general incorporation. And the basic idea there was we have a general interest in promoting the creation of wealth. So this is a way to create wealth so companies can incorporate and have limited liability. So that was the rationale. And again, you could argue whether that was a good or bad thing, but it clearly was, you know, it was explicit policy at the time. Everyone understood that, you know, this was a government policy to promote wealth. It wasn't just something that was out there in the world. We were going to do this as a way to promote wealth. And, you know, the other point I was going to make is that we also set rules of corporate governance. And, you know, those are actually very extensive. Most of the rules are designed to basically protect minority rights. So, you know, I own shares in Microsoft. I own, you know, say 1,000 shares of Microsoft or something. Well, we want to make it, or I should say we, whether we want to or not, the rules make it so that you can't have a situation where some group gets control of 50.1% of Microsoft and then tells me and everyone else that are in the minority, I'm just taking all your shares.
Yeah.
So that's what most of the rules of corporate governance are around. But the point is that, you know, the rules, there's nothing intrinsic to the corporation that sets those rules. We could set those rules in different ways. And one of the points that I've been trying to make in some of my work recently is that the rules are very much skewed now to give management an enormous say. So I'm actually, people think this is weird, I actually argue for more shareholder rights, because what I would say is where you have these CEOs that are getting $20, $30, $40 million salaries, they're ripping off the shareholders. And it's not necessarily that I have so much sympathy for the shareholders. I mean, most of the shares are held by very rich people, but some of them aren't rich. Middle-class people, 401ks and pension funds, of course, have shares. So not all of them are rich. All the CEOs are rich, that we know. So in that sense, you know, I think, you know, I'd rather see the money go to the shareholders. But what's a more important point to me is that this affects pay structures throughout the economy. So if the CEO is getting $30 million, the CFO, the other top people, they're probably getting $10 or $15 million. And even the third echelon, you get to people who are senior, but, you know, below these people in standing, they're probably getting $1 or $2 million. And it just stands to reason, the more money is going to those people, less for everyone else. So I would actually like to see groups more say, because I need want to see them be in a position to rein in CEO pay, because the CEOs are not doing them a favor when they charge, you know, basically charge the shareholders $30 million for their service. You can sure get plenty of people to do the job just fine for $2 or $3 million. I mean, this gets to the point about progressive taxation. There are plenty, you know, it's very rare that you have a CEO like Steve Jobs, a real visionary. Those people are very few and far between. The vast majority, I'm sure they're smart, I'm sure they're hardworking, but the person next in line is just as smart and just as hardworking. So you aren't going to lose anything if they go, oh, it's not worth it to me for $2 or $3 million.
And even then, is anyone worth having billions and billions of dollars, no matter how talented they are?
That I think is at least a debatable point, you know, because if, you know, I mean, I never met Steve Jobs, and I don't know, you know, he might well have been very creative, even for a tenth the money he got, you know, maybe even a hundredth of the money, you know, there's certainly, you know, where you have, you know, getting back to Greg Mankiw always talking, I don't know, Taylor, but I mean, many of the people we think of as great artists, great musicians, they're committed to their work. You know, they probably would do it for a tenth the pay. You know, you go back in time, I won't advocate this, but how much did Vincent van Gogh ever get for his paintings? I don't think he sold one in his lifetime. I think his brother died to him.
He died poor, yeah.
You know, but here he was maybe the best artist in all history, you know. And you think of Charlie Parker, the fantastic jazz musician. He died in poverty. You know, again, I'm not advocating that these people should be poor, but the idea that they have to get enormous sums to be creative and, you know,
to be motivated, and that greed, that money is the only thing that motivates them. That sounds more like something a rentier would say, is that money is the only thing that motivates him. People will do creative work, especially if their basic needs are being met. So my husband is a psychiatrist, and so he's read a lot of these reports on, and is fascinated by these reports on what amount of money it would require to make people happy. And it turns out that it's not a lot. It's, you know, basic necessities, healthcare, shelter, you know, being able to provide for your kids' college and those sorts of things. That make people tremendously happy. And if you have those things, you're going to work on what's interesting to you. I know it's speculation, and I'm an optimist, humanist optimist in that sense. I believe that that's what people will do.
I'm inclined to agree with that. And, you know, of course, the key thing is not just the money that they have, but they're secure. So
they
want to know that, you know, they have healthcare insurance today, but they aren't going to lose it tomorrow. And, you know, that's a really important thing, because obviously that's a big fear that people have today. They, you know, they might think, oh, you know, I have a decent job and, you know, I could afford my mortgage, my rent, pay for my healthcare insurance, but I could lose the job tomorrow. You know, that's a realistic fear that they have.
Yeah, what I've been through in the last year and a half, a pretty bad health crisis, and I have nothing but gratitude for the good healthcare that I have through Microsoft, that most people in this country don't have healthcare that's that good, because we have a sort of Cadillac insurance policy with Primera, but most people don't have anything like that kind of security. And it's astonishing to me that there hasn't been more of an organized uprising in this regard. Hopefully there will be.
Yeah, no, I'm hopeful that, you know, in the next election, we'll see some real movement towards establishing a genuine universal system. I mean, I thought the Affordable Care Act was a big step forward, but obviously does not go nearly far enough. But I think it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. So the formulation of the CEPR, what motivated you to co-found this organization, and what do they do, and what are you continuing to do with them these days?
Well, you know, it had been the Economic Policy Institute, and, you know, I appreciate the time I worked there and everything, but I felt that it was overly bureaucratic, because they were, you know, very cautious and everything, and, you know, a lot of layers of bureaucracy. I used to joke with someone, and they say, how long will something take? I'd say, well, imagine it taking as long as you could possibly envision. Double that and add 6 months. No, that was obviously being somewhat facetious, but, you know, what I felt was there are a lot of issues that, you know, we could have an impact on, but we often had to act quickly, and I didn't think that the Economic Policy Institute gave me that room. So I felt I formed Center for Economic and Policy Research with an old friend of mine from grad school, Mark Weisbrot, and we felt that that was basically what we wanted to do. There's a lot of policy issues that we could have an impact that, you know, if we, but we just have to move quickly. And one of the big ones at that time, we had a book come out literally as we were starting it, Social Security, the Phony Crisis, and taking issue with a view that was held really across the political spectrum, or the, you know, political spectrum in Washington, I should say, that Social Security faced a crisis. Because I had any number of Democrats, Democratic pollsters, I remember once one of them just telling me, you know, basically, you know, you have to acknowledge there's a crisis or people just won't take you seriously. You know, it was based on his polling, his focus groups. And we didn't accept that. We felt, A, the data, it wasn't true, and B, you know, if you talk, people would listen. And
it was an absurd rallying point. I had college teachers that actually would say in class that Social Security was going to be bankrupt in a couple decades and that none of us could rely on it. And it just seemed ridiculous to me that something like that could ever come to pass when we have more money in this country than we know what to do with.
Yeah, you know, and you know, I remember I spoke, of course, around the country many times on this. And I remember, you know, I knew at that time, I knew the Social Security trustees projections pretty much inside out. And I just go, okay, let's say they're all exactly right. Here's what it looks like. And, you know, it doesn't go away. You know, you face a shortfall. But, you know, literally the idea there'll be no money, that's literally, I mean, again, assuming you never did anything, just, and they're exactly right in all their projections. But when I couldn't convince them, you know, I'd say, speaking to a college class, the line I'd always go, okay, so, you know, we have some point in the future, is it 10 years, is it 20, you know, I'd have them give me a year, you know, at some point, okay, so we're not paying Social Security benefits. So then I go, okay, so in this year, you know, this is back in the 90s, so in this year, you know, 2015, are we still going to have an army? Looking at me like, of course. Okay. Are we still going to have our court system? Yeah. Are people in Congress still going to be, you know, getting paid? I go, okay, so we're going to be paying for the army, paying for our courts. Congress people are still going to, but we're going to have 30 million people who are over 65, and we're going to tell them that there's no money for their benefits.
Yeah.
You know, you just go, okay, that makes zero sense. That is not going to happen. So anyhow, but that was, you know, you know, obviously we didn't do it. You can't do anything alone as a small think tank, but we helped, I think, change the tide on that. And, you know, by 2005, you know, when Bush tried to privatize, the Democrats are no longer saying there's a crisis. And of course, more recently, you know, many, if not most Democrats have been calling for increasing benefits, which I think would be a good thing.
It definitely would be. My aunt and uncle rely on it critically. And I mean, obviously it's a necessary thing to have. And I don't like part of the narrative about Social Security that it is money you paid into it, so therefore you're entitled to it later. Because it was set up originally paying benefits to people who had not paid into it. And that has always been the way it's worked, that the current working force is subsidizing the retirees, which makes sense. I mean, ideologically, it's, you know, it's progressive and it's comforting, but that's not the way that it's spun usually.
Yeah, well, I sort of like the idea that people think they have a right to it, you know, so in that sense, I think that part of it's good because it makes it much, much harder to...
Oh, yeah, definitely a human right.
Yeah.
But healthcare also should be a human right, and it should be something that is available to everyone. Just as a funny aside, when I was, I try not to get on LinkedIn or any other social media and get into debates very often because my husband yells at me about doing that. So it's such a time drain. I'm not even on Facebook anymore. And I wouldn't be anyway after, you know, the revelations of how they're using and abusing data. But there was this man on LinkedIn that was arguing that so many of us are complaining about how we're running out of water, we're running out of coral reefs, we're running out of fish, temperature is changing, and, you know, there's scarcity of oil and all these things. And he said, but what about the real problem, that there's scarcity of money? And I just wrote back and said, you know, in a certain respect, money's a number in a spreadsheet. It's more complicated than that, but I thought that was astonishing that people are that, they have this mindset of a gold standard, you know, that money intrinsically is of value when it really is just supposed to be a proxy for value. I don't know. It was a funny interaction.
Yeah, no, a lot of people hold strange views. I was once debating some libertarian guy, I forget the exact topic, but you know, it was something related to the Federal Reserve Board. And I remember this woman came up to me afterwards because we were at a reception, and she said, you know, she's very polite, and she goes, do you, I forget exactly how she put it, but basically, do you think gold has intrinsic value? Well, you know, if you want the jewelry or something, but that, no.
Yeah, that's what I said to a coworker, actually my tech lead at Microsoft. He made a comment about that if money were underwritten by gold. And I said, well, the problem is gold and precious jewels and precious stones, it doesn't really have value if you think about it. Well, it is true that electrical wiring in your house, if it's gold instead of copper, it's more
resistant to oxidation.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that, but is that, does that justify, you know, this crazy belief that it is somehow intrinsically valuable?
No, it's amazing. It's actually one of the most basic social conventions, but it is just a social convention.
It's otherwise nonsense that we just take for granted. And I had never really thought about that seriously until this past year. Because, you know, if somebody asks you about gold, you say, oh, yeah, it's valuable. Should I buy some bricks of gold and bury them under my house? Yeah, let's see. Well, here's an interesting question about an actual market system. At what scale do you think market economies, what do you think, what scale can they actually exist? Obviously, it doesn't seem to work, you know, as an overarching theme, but are there macrocosms where it does work and work well?
Well, I mean, I think we've gotten a huge amount out of a market economy, so I wouldn't deride it. I mean, it's just that, you know, you have to set the rules, and you know, it's interesting, and I won't claim expertise on, you know, the platform economy, but it's totally non-controversial among economists that where you have a natural monopoly, say electric companies, just to be clear, when I'm saying electric companies, I mean the people who actually lay the lines to your house. So I understand we could have competing generators, but no one's going to lay duplicate electric lines to my house.
Yeah.
That they have to be regulated because, you know, here it is, it's a essential service and, you know, there is no competitor, you know, so it's totally non-controversial among economists. I mean, maybe you could find one libertarian somewhere who has some story why you don't have to regulate it, but that, you know, that's basically non-controversial. And it seems that we have something similar with, you know, things like Facebook, things like Google, you know, that they have, for practical purposes, monopolies, you know, that's a story. It's just like, well, you then have to regulate them because they could obviously exploit them at, you know, endlessly, and they seem to be doing that. So that seems to cry out for regulation, you know, both in terms of, you know, what they could do with your information, because I'm sure, you know, Facebook in particular, but probably Google, doing all sorts of things with information about us that we wouldn't want them doing, but we
absolutely
don't.
Absolutely, yeah.
Control. But also what they could charge, because again, you can't have, no one's going to lay the second electric wire. No one's going to have the serious competitor to Google. You know, those are clear cases where, you know, we need to rein them in. I mean, other aspects, you know, to me, it's kind of unproblematic. People talk about, you know, putting up that, you know, with greenhouse gas emissions that, you know, that somehow we have to restrict the market. And to my view, again, it's defining the market. I mean, we know greenhouse gas emissions cause, you know, are causing global warming. So, you know, the analogy I make, it's not an interference in the market if I tell my neighbor that he can't dump his sewage on my lawn.
Right.
You know, and that's what we're saying with, you know, with greenhouse gas emissions, that we have to restrict them because it's not just something you're doing privately. You're throwing this into the atmosphere. If you have a way to you know, you're going to burn oil and you have a way to, you know, suck in all the carbon emissions so that that's fine. It wouldn't bother me. I mean, there's still issues with the extraction, but, you know, in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions, all right, fine. If you could deal with that, well, you can't. I mean, just to be clear. But I mean, if you came up with some brilliant way to do that, all right, well, then I guess, you know, we don't have to worry about burning oil. So I don't know. I mean, it's just, you have to think clearly about what you want the market for, what it's doing in specific circumstances.
Use it as the tool. Yeah. Rather than overarching philosophy, but more just one of the many tools.
Exactly.
That you have. It's interesting. You mentioned the greenhouse gas regulation because it brings to mind the notion of the externality, which I heard when I was at Georgia Tech. Ken Arrow came to give a talk and he mentioned externalities extensively and how much complexity that adds into any kind of market economy, and that a lot of these things are things that we have to consider and regulate, just like what you said.
Yeah, yeah, no, he was a very good economist, very thoughtful.
Yeah. I happen to work in data science. I'm a statistician working at Bing Ads, although I'm not working on the actual ad space. So unfortunately, you can say that I'm in that bemoaned financial sector, and I can't believe that I found my way into it and decrying it the whole time. But I continue to derogate it. But I think also there is this problem of data and regulation of data. You know, Facebook can keep tabs on what you're doing and then exploit that using machine learning to figure out exactly how to target you with ads. And I wonder to what extent, I was thinking aloud about this and ended up writing a pretty long blog post about it on my other blog. some of the complexities that come up in this, and that I feel like tighter regulation is coming. But what is your take on data and the way that it's appropriated for profits? I get a sense, even though I know this would be hard to regulate, I feel like people whose data is used to generate money should either be told very clearly that's going to happen or be in on, you know, a cut of the profits.
I think we have to do one or both. Again, I, you know, these get into issues that I've just looked at very, very cursorily. But the idea that, you know, Facebook or Google can get all this data on people, you know, again, it, you know, first and foremost, I think very few people appreciate how much data they could actually get on you, and then be sharing it with what they're doing with it. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know if I'd want to, well, I should say, I definitely would know that I don't want every search I've ever done on Google to be public.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely not.
Now, you know, presumably they won't do that. They'd have no reason to do it, at least that I know of. But, you know, in principle, they have access to it. They could. No, I don't think there's any. So I think there have to be clear restrictions on how this data can be used. And as you say, if they're profiting from it, it seems reasonable. Well, one, you may, I mean, think of it in different directions. One, you restrict how much they can profit. You could say that, okay, you have to share that with, you know, the people you got it from.
Right.
I've not studied closely enough, so I really can't speak with expertise, but I do, I will say, I don't think the current system is working, and, you know, meaning I don't think the people who are basically giving them the money are happy with it.
Right, right. I'll send you the article that I wrote.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be interested.
Noam Chomsky was kind enough to read an earlier draft of it and thought that it raised some interesting points. So I think you may find it interesting because it touches on some arenas where data is being used in shocking ways that I didn't know going into writing the article. I would not have believed that data was used in this particular capacity. For instance, it's used to sentence criminals, and it's used to dispatch police patrols in various cities so that the data can reinforce racist stereotypes, because they, you know, originally would be patrolling, say, black neighborhoods and harassing black people. And if the data confirms that that's where they've been and that's where they've found, you know, either vagrancy or underage drinking or whatever, I mean, the things that that you have everywhere across obviously all races, all features. But they don't send the police into white communities as much. So the data tells you to go to the black communities, and then they can say the data is the justification for it. And not own up to the actual racism that, you know, systemic racism that promotes that.
Yeah, so that's classic.
You said that you're semi-retired now to work on sanctuary for puppy dogs. So tell me about that a little bit. And what's next for you?
Well, you know, basically I have to say it was kind of wearing on me being in D.C. because I got up at 4:30 every morning, and then, you know, after a while it does take a toll on you. And I just, you know, my wife and I both decided we wanted to change. So we'd been coming out here, the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, we've been volunteering here since probably about 10 years ago. I'm not sure when exactly our first year out here was. And, you know, we love doing that. And it's a beautiful area here. We're halfway between Zion and Grand Canyon National Parks. So it's just this really big area. And, you know, I just felt that I wanted to change a pace, work somewhat less, you know, play with the dogs, love dogs. We have our own, but also the dogs there, help them out. And, you know, basically be able to work on a more measured schedule. So, you know, what's nice here is I work on things that I think are important. I don't have to worry about funders, what they think is important. So I could work on the things I want to do. Say I probably still put in, my goal is to put in 20. I probably put in 30, 40 hours a week, but in any case, much less than I had been doing. And so I think I could still make a contribution, still get involved in the debates I've been doing, and just avoid a lot of what I considered often a waste of time getting pulled into things in D.C.
Right.
We've been here a little over 6 months now, and we're both very happy with it.
I would imagine so. I feel like D.C. would be a hard city to live in, irrespective of the fact that you have all these corrupt people.
Yeah, well, the nice aspects to D.C., I mean, they have a very nice park right in the middle of the city, Rock Creek Park, that we actually live close to. In fact, the whole time we were there, we lived in two different neighborhoods, but both were very close to Rock Creek Park. So there are aspects of it that are very nice, but, you know, we could walk literally to anywhere in the city here. It's a tiny town. It's, you know, 4,500 people. So
wow,
be able to do.
Final word on this. Your book, The Conservative Nanny State, to me is, I mean, there may be better books that you've written as far as the points that you make or the data you present, I'm not sure, but I found it to be a revelation. I think that like Piketty's work, I think that it could be as important to the lay person, the lay sort of amateur economist, in understanding contemporary economics, as, you know, Chomsky is in the history of technology, or Zinn is in the history of the United States. So thank you.
Thanks.
So
that's
much.
That's really quite a compliment. Great.
Thank you very much, and you enjoy the rest of your Friday.
You too. I enjoyed the interview.
Yeah, thanks. Bye-bye.